John Loney is the author of A Beautiful Bailout. He says there is a revolution of social innovation occurring in which nonprofits and social enterprises are learning to shake off the yoke of colonial funding paradigms. He puts it clearly and bluntly. Nonprofits do not need more funding. They need more revenue. Governments should no longer be seen as funders, but now as customers. He calls on nonprofits to get up from the kids' table and value their outcomes and to stop giving them away for free. He calls out Indian agents and kudos entrepreneurs. He points out how it is now more entrepreneurial to be a nonprofit than a for-profit, as well as how foundations and governments can and must up their game. During our conversation, he explores the converging forces civil society organizations and social enterprises are well placed to leverage for heightened social outcomes. His proposals are poignant and revolutionary in their consequences. That revolution is being empowered by trends in social procurement, social finance, and social enterprise. As some of us begin to contemplate post-pandemic restructuring and the inevitable requirement to do things differently than they were done before, John's proposals provide a map and the tools for the task. So, Sean, you foresee a tremendous opportunity in this field you call social enterprise. Share a little bit about this opportunity that you see.
Yeah, I see social enterprises as a disruptive business model. And it doesn't mean we do things better. It means we do things differently. It's on some other scale.
Okay.
By disruptive business model, I'm also thinking of recent disruptions such as Airbnb and Uber. They've just completely changed those sectors. And I see no reason why social enterprises aren't going to do the same thing. We can outcompete the private sector every time if we value the work that we do. And what I think nonprofits and social enterprises need to understand is that the main financial beneficiary of the work that we do is the government. And so I think where we need to get our headspace at is getting government to value those benefits. And that's what's going to allow us to scale.
So you see a business opportunity with the government as a potential market?
That's correct. Okay. So in The Beautiful Bailout, we're really describing how we turn government from a funder, which is a very colonial way of looking at things, into a customer. And, you know, so looking at social procurement differently in that we can sell to government things that they're already buying. So building up this t-shirt from Toronto, for example, one of their main customers is Toronto Housing, and which is publicly owned housing. And so we can sell to them things like painting and other trades-based work, but we can also sell to government things that they're not currently buying, which they desperately want, which is social outcomes. And that's what The Beautiful Bailout is about, is how do nonprofits and social enterprises engage government to get them buying our most valuable outcomes, which is a reduction in very expensive social problems.
What's involved in making that case to government? If you'd think that if the case was clear, that space would already be fairly alive and highly functioning, but clearly it's not, because this is a new opportunity. So what's the step that needs to be?
Great question. I think the main thing is nonprofits, we've got to get up from the kids' table and value our outcomes and stop giving them away. We're very good at giving away our very valuable outcomes. And surrounding all of that is an understanding of funding. So funding is very colonial. We're the only group in society when we interact with government that government pulls out this funding idea. So you with funding, if you're a nonprofit, and it just seems normal to us because this is all that we know. Right. When I started Build with others in 2006, we were just going for funding, and because that's what nonprofits do.
Which is a fairly demoralizing process.
Yeah, but if that's all you know, then that's what you do. And interestingly, something happens that nonprofits are going to begin to understand is that we make a case to government, well, why don't you fund us more? In the case of Build in 2000, and this would be, you know, we started 2006, but by 2008, did lineups of people looking for work. We're talking hundreds of people with criminal records, knowing we'd hire them because they had no work experience, criminal records, no driver's license, couldn't do trades-based math because no one showed them how to use a tape measure. I mean, you'd be crazy to hire them, but they're interacting with government at very expensive levels.
Right.
And this is simple. We'll just go to government and explain that they need to fund us more and we'll save them tons of money. And then government tells nonprofits something which is really critical that nonprofits understand what they're saying. They're saying, we cannot afford to save money. And that's the end of the paradigm, Peter. When we're government hears themselves saying that, and nonprofits call them out on it, and which we've done, but it can't stop. We can't go and make a case for more funding. Funding is about compliance. It's not about outcomes. And how the heck do you value your outcomes if you're engaging with government based on compliance? And what other sector in society does government say, well, we're going to agree ahead of time on what the budget's going to be. We want you to have no administrative costs. We'll fund you for a couple of years, and then you got to go find it somewhere else as though there's some magical pots of money out there. We want to see all of your receipts, and you can't have any money left over afterwards. I mean, can you imagine if government said that to the private sector? I mean, they would give them the single-fingered salute so fast they would know what happened, right? So, but here's how it works when the private sector is engaged. It works amazingly well. A company is selected to build a bridge. Let's say it's a $200 million tender. They don't give the company the money up front. The company goes and borrows the money from investors. $150 million. They don't need the whole $200 million. It's $150 million. They go, they build the bridge, they manage all the subcontractors. Somebody from government comes along with a pen and paper and looks at the bridge and says, well, you've delivered the outcome. Here's $200 million. The company then pays the investors back the $150 million, and the other $50 million goes in their pockets. And you know that is an outcomes oriented relationship where government is concerned about the outcomes. Now, if partway through that process the private sector company says, "Oh, there's a new kind of cement out, and it's stronger, and it's cheaper, and it's faster," they'll just go and use that. They just pivot. Right. They don't have to go back to government and say,
right,
"Hey, we got a new way of doing things." The lack of trust that we've built up with governments because we've submitted ourselves to this colonial process is really what the problem is. So to answer your question, why hasn't this happened? And I think it's incumbent upon nonprofits and social enterprises to value our outcomes and say enough of this colonial process. And we're gonna do something radical here. So what nonprofits are doing now is they're going to government saying, will you please give us some funding so we can do something good? And government's like, no, not happening. We don't have it. If we gave you funding, we'd have to take it away from someone else. I mean, that's what colonialism is all about. It's a scarcity about solutions and scarcity around around solutions. And so what nonprofits, what I'm encouraging them to go to government instead and say, will you agree to save money? And then enter into a relationship with them based on outcomes, not funding. So then nonprofits will look kind of confused and say, well, where are we supposed to get the money from? And this is a big difference between when I wrote an Army of Problem Solvers and the Beautiful Bailout. The Army of Problem Solvers, it's a standalone book. Like, the Beautiful Bailout is not like an update of it. They're two different books. Right. But in an Army of Problem Solvers, I don't mention the word foundation, because to me, they were useless to us, because foundations were engaged in funding projects and were about systems change.
Right.
And they didn't seem interested in systems change. So why would we waste our effort on that when, as a social entrepreneur, that's all we care about?
Right.
So these foundations came to us, Community Foundations of Canada, McConnell Foundation, Lawson Foundation, Harbinger, and others, and said, you know, we've signed this document that says we're going to take the Truth and Reconciliation Commission seriously. We don't quite know what that means, but we have a hunch, you know, you folks in Winnipeg who are doing social enterprise work and having a great deal of trouble with government, that maybe we could work together. Mm. And interestingly, so what's key for people to understand about foundations is that there's 10,000 of them in Canada, and they're supposed to be working in the public interest. They all have got a mandate from Revenue Canada to act as a foundation, as a charitable organization.
Right.
But Revenue Canada says, you know, at a minimum, you are supposed to grant 3.5% of that on an annual basis. Well, what about the other 96.5%?
Right.
It's in the private sector, often doing things that are causing more problems than the granting is resolving. So these foundations are like, why, you know, why are we invested in Kentucky Fried Chicken and Tim Hortons and Old Dutch potato chips and sugary drinks on the 96.5%? And on the 3.5%, we're granting this, you know, pittance of money to nonprofits to try to resolve these problems.
On a project basis.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe, and just giving our outcomes to government also. Like,
right.
Foundations also need to understand that they're doing the granting work, the outcomes coming from the granting work, they're just saying to government, here you go, government, have it for free.
Right.
We don't want you to value what it is that we do. So what the Beautiful Bailout is proposing is a new way of getting these partners together, nonprofits, impact investors, and we've given government a new name, outcomes purchasers. And the idea wasn't our idea. It was came together a result of a conversation. The way this works is named by Jeff Sear from Raven Indigenous Capital Partners, and they set up by foundations to work in Indigenous space, community driven outcomes purchasing, and we really like it. Government really likes it. It's community based, and it's sort of the coming together of these three entities. We've got nonprofits being more entrepreneurial. We've got investors saying, you know, we want a financial and a social rate of return. And then on top of that, we've got government saying we want to save some money. And governments are exhausted. People need to understand that. And I love how out of the UK, Sir Ronald Cohen, who kind of he had a whole career of investing in the tech sector, and so he was kind of credited with coming up with a social impact bond. But social impact bond is really like investors who care trying to bring their way of doing things into the nonprofit world. And so there's some major limitations, and they don't actually work very well. But it was a great first generation version of recognizing that funding is not going to be the solution.
So what are some of the lessons learned in that effort to jump from investing in the private sector and private sector ways to investing in social impact? So how are they different?
Yeah, great question. So Sir Ronald says something I think that's key, just as a bit of background before I answer that question. He said, well, you know, originally there's social problems and philanthropists were handling it.
Sure.
And charities, and they just threw their hands up and they were, we can't keep up.
Right.
And then government came in and they said, well, we'll weigh in. I mean, that we'll handle these expensive social problems. And I think they're now throwing their hands up in the air and saying, this is insane. Like we can't keep up. So what these investors couldn't understand is that, well, there's a fantastical rate of return. So what we need is to liberate investment. And that's true. But they haven't worked in government before. I was a senior civil servant with the provincial government, and I could have an idea of how government functions and how nonprofits function. And so it's really based on risk. Like, civil servants are trained to avoid risk. And so here's the risk with social impact bonds. So you've got a private investor. So their civil servants are worried that somebody's going to say, well, hey, that guy is making a lot of money on this person's misery, whether it be, you know, diabetes or because their kids are in care or whatever. And we got to make sure that the rate of return is reasonable. And so we're going to quantify the hell out of this deal. And so what that means is massive costs and effort based right. on justifying this rate of return. And everything slows down and the costs go up. And those are the two things you don't want when you're trying to solve social problems is slow and expensive. We're trying to get away from that. So that's number one problem. Number two problem is that the investors and government are in control, not the community. And with this community-driven outcomes purchasing, it's the community that's in the driver's seat. We're the ones that are determining how we're going to do things, what it is that we need, and it's their job, outcomes purchasers and impact investors. And this is how one of the ways I define social innovation is it's simply this. Just make it easy for problem solvers. Like, you hear these academic definitions of what social innovation is.
Yeah.
I try to get people to understand it in two ways. Just, you know, it's not complicated. Just make it easy for problem solvers and let us do our work. And the second thing is this idea of turning government from a funder into a customer.
Right.
That's, to me, social innovation. I mean, it could be other things, but if we're about solving problems, we know that problems are expensive. And thank God they're expensive. And I kind of see this as the upside of down, also part of this, looking at things differently. Like in our context here in Manitoba, 3/4 of people, when they get out of jail, are back in contact with the justice system within 2 years. It's $80,000 a year.
Yeah, I think that's similar right across the country. Yeah,
yeah, in any developed country, it's asinine. And then we've in Manitoba alone, Peter, we have 10,000 Indigenous kids in care with almost no supports for the parents. It's also $80,000 a year per kid in care. You know, 75% of our healthcare expenditures are now on diseases where diet is a main risk factor. Oh my God. And you just keep going down the list. Like homelessness costs an enormous amount of money. And it's like people standing on the street isn't what's costing the money. It's the interaction with the emergency service providers. 85% of what police now do has nothing to do with crime. And in Winnipeg, 1/3 of our property taxes pay for police. And you know what? We could probably use more because they are expected, the police, to go and you know, whenever somebody's causing any kind of disruption, they just go and it's like, hey, Dave, what the hell are you doing, man? We talked about this yesterday, right? And then back, you know, the fire truck shows up, the ambulance shows up, they take them to the emergency ward at the hospital, they end up in a mental health bed. Well, in Barrie, Ontario, Simcoe County, there's 400 homeless people who are in regular contact with the emergency services. And each of those 400, on average, there's 43 incidents a year of the process that I just described. Each of those incidents costs $3,000. So you're looking at $130,000 a year per person. Why? Because there's no supportive housing for this sister or brother or son or daughter. And so this is the failure of funding. And we've long known that ending homelessness saves money. But we got nonprofits going to government saying, you know, making a better case for funding. And funding is not about outcomes. It's about compliance. Show us your receipts. So what this process is to say, well, we're going to go and borrow money from an impact investor, with, like the private sector would do. We're going to invest in social housing and supportive housing, whatever these people need, and because it's going to be more than just housing. It's going to be very holistic. And then we're going to sell what supportive housing does to the emergency service providers. And then,
so this kind of makes sense because you're parsing what money is for what. For example, the government no longer is funding a programmatic response or a highly compliance or risk mitigation approach to addressing a problem. Exactly. So they're stepping out of that and now purchasing and measuring outcomes, but not necessarily having to put the upfront cash out. So you're sort of pulling it all apart.
That's key. And just say to government, there's two things you need to focus on. Well, you need to focus on the outcomes, but and what does that mean? It means you have to agree to save money, right? That's the first thing.
Let's just unpack that a little bit. Like, when, how does the answer to that question manifest as no thank you? Like, how is it that
Well, it kind of comes along with the second part of it, okay, which is you need to agree to save money, and you need to let go, and you need to let go right fucking now.
Right.
Like, people need you to let go.
Right.
Because that's what colonialism is, right? It's about control. And here's the deal, is that they're saying yes, because this way of interacting with them de-risks the whole thing.
Okay, so that's elemental. Then
you don't have to worry about something not working. You don't have to worry about these untrustworthy nonprofits going and pilfering your money, and you don't have to look at our receipts. Just focus on the outcomes.
Well, in some degree, it makes very little sense for a culture Let's just in broad strokes suggest that the governmental culture is a risk management and risk mitigating culture.
Exactly.
It makes very little sense to ask that culture to get into a dynamic, emergent, organic, specific local situation with their approach. What we need is innovators on the ground who can respond quickly to organic and emergent opportunity without thinking about necessarily. You can't sense an opportunity through risk mitigation processes.
No, if that's what you're paid to worry about.
Right.
And what we're finding is, and in the beautiful bailout, I take some time to talk about, the book starts out with a story of an early civil servant named William Graham. It's 1905, and he's an Indian agent. And he's in the prairies, we have numbered treaties, and each Indian is supposed to get $5. And in the story, there's much more to it. I love the story because it describes things from different angles. But
it does carry the theme through the book very nicely.
Yes, thank you. Well, I was amazed when I found this guy's his memoirs, and he describes this. But around the outside of the 3,000 Indians that were there were these Hudson's Bay traders, and their wagons, he describes them, are being so full that you could hear the wagons creaking under the weight of the merchandise ready for sale. And the point of the story is many, but one of the points is that it's a setup, right? Like, that's outside companies that are benefiting from the way government is distributing money.
Right. So in the story, William Graham has money to give to each Indian.
Yes, $5 bills. He says, I can't give them $1 $5 bill because they might want four more. They're too stupid to know the difference. He basically says that.
Right. And distribution is happening in a marketplace populated by Hudson's Bay purveyors. Right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And so now we would call him an Indian agent. In the book, I say, well, there's an enemy of the Indian agent, and they're called intrapreneurs.
Yes.
And they're people who change the system from the inside. And I'm in the book, I'm trying to hold them up by saying, you go, right? You do it. We're dependent on you. And to change that system from the inside. And those intrapreneurs are generally women, and they're generally younger. And you can tell an entrepreneur, give me 5 minutes and I'll tell you whether an Indian agent or an entrepreneur. Like, if they if they're critical of the system and say, what we're doing is not working. Whereas the Indian agent will say, well, we got the solar panel up on the band office. You know, it's worked. Clearly, this funding system's working. It's like, okay, well, who put the solar panel up? What was the name of the company? It was from outside. And what was the cost per watt? I was like, well, it was very expensive. I mean, we had to put a tendering system. By the way, tendering, that's what it does, is it brings in companies from the outside. Mm-hmm. It's one of the failures of the colonial system. And, well, what about the other 499 buildings on the reserve? Like, what about those? And it's like, well, I guess we'll get more funding. And, so then an entrepreneur will say, well, we need to do things differently. That's going to mean partnering in a different way. And the existing system is broken. And communities, they can do something for themselves. Whereas the Indian agent is like, well, they're just Indians. Like, they can't do anything for themselves. Like, you can't garden in Garden Hill. Like, whoever came up with that idea? Like, you know what, bud? There were gardens in Garden Hill that were very successful. And you wrecked them by bringing in your social assistance system, which promotes dependency, by having a Nutrition North Canada subsidy program that actually gives money to the northern store or monopolies on First Nations that sell mostly unhealthy food. And get this, Peter, it excludes any food that's raised, harvested, grown locally because it's local, right? Like, and you got child welfare systems where if a child welfare agency wants to do family reunification, and there's indigenous models that are 80% successful with a tiny amount of money compared to the amount of money and resources needed to keep the kids in care. And if that child welfare agency embarks upon a program to reunite kids with their parents, they're financially punished because they're paid on a per kid in care basis. So you just keep going through these systems, and you have to ask ourselves, what the hell are we doing with this funding of projects when the system is just so utterly broken? And we've got to change the systems. And so most foundations in Canada are still saying, no, we don't want to change the system. We just want to fund some projects. And, you know, that's up to government to change the system.
Well, and this, you know, this all seems to, I mean, I wonder to what degree is it true to say that the degree and depth and seeming intractability of our social problems is a result of the system that we continue to repeat.
Yeah, and I think nonprofits know that.
Right.
Like, I think that, but, you know, government has made it perfectly clear. If you guys aren't getting the message, you're never going to get it. They're not coming to solve our problems. They're not coming.
Well, and maybe that's a good thing, given that the approaches so far don't solve the problems.
But then why are we asking them? Why are we making ourselves dependent upon them?
And that seems to be our narrative, doesn't it?
And we just say, you know what? We have what they need, which is what nonprofits do in this scenario is that we save government money. So why don't we go and save them some money, but not a little bit, a lot. And there's, I think that's really key. So your question a while ago was a good one. Like, let's unpack a bit what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So you've got, what would be a good example? Well, let's use the example of Aki Energy. Aki Energy is a social enterprise that I and others founded in 2013, mm-hmm. I think. And we started using on-bill financing to install ground source heat pumps on First Nations. So Manitoba Hydro would give us around $20,000. We'd train the First Nations, start their own social enterprise. They would install the ground source heat pump in the home. The bills, energy bills, would collapse, be cut in half, and 20,000 kilowatt hours per year.
Right.
And Manitoba Hydro would say, well, we want our money back. They're a fantastic partner. So, you know, they put a financing charge on the bill, which they continue to collect until they're made whole,
right,
with their $20,000.
Right.
And the government of Canada came along, and this I talk about mostly in an army of problem solvers,
right,
is like, no, you can't do that. If you want to work on First Nations, you do it our way, which is you apply for funding. And what that means, it's about the control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And saying, we don't want to save money. That's not what this is about. This is about controlling you, the solution providers.
And it seems like for no reason other than for control. Like, it's hard to imagine what the other intention or purpose might be.
Yeah, we sent the vice president of Manitoba Hydro over there. It's like, buddy, I don't understand. It's like, we have the risk. All you got to do is agree to save money and let go, right? It's like, no, we're not letting go. That's not how this works. So what they're saying is that if you want to do geothermal First Nations, you got to wait, and then there might be some funding available. And then we're going to put out a tender, and then that tender brings in the outside company, and they install shitty equipment, and no one locally has any idea how to maintain it,
right,
or anything.
Right.
And, I mean, this is why we have boil water advisories, right? That's the reason.
Right. It's
the same process. So, I mean, they're insistent on that. And so as I wrote about this in an army of problem solvers, these foundations said, well, you know, going to be really hard to overcome these Indian agents, because they actually have more juice than the minister. Like, we had lots of access to ministerial levels, but they couldn't they couldn't stand up to the Indian agents.
So when you say Indian agents, in this case, you're speaking of bureaucrats.
Civil service. Yes.
Okay.
Not entrepreneurs,
right.
For sure.
Right. And so not the political elected officials and not the entrepreneurs, but as a particular kind of civil servant with a particular bent that you call an Indian agent.
Indian agent, yeah. And so they're like, no, I don't care what the minister says. They don't know what they're talking about. We're just going to wait them out. They call them migratory birds. They'll come and go. It's not a problem. So
the Indian agents call the political.
Yes.
Migratory birds. Like they'll come and go. We'll still be here.
Yeah. They're just naive. They don't know what they're talking about. It's like they clearly don't understand that this is a bad way of doing things. Like we can't let the community have control. Like we've had a whole career of being trained to suppress anything that smells like that.
It sounds fundamentally anti-democratic, Sean.
Yeah, and costly for taxpayers, right?
Right.
The beautiful bailout, interestingly, endorsed by the Winnipeg Chambers of Commerce.
Beautiful.
The National Police Chiefs Association of Canada. But it's because we're learning to talk to people differently. So, you know, instead of telling people they're wrong, you tell them they're right. Government is too big, not too small.
Well, if I have it right, at the early days of the progressive movement, it was small businesses and civil society organizations working locally to differentiate themselves from large publicly traded corporations, large governments, and unions, which were very quickly in collusion and becoming corrupt. So to some degree, it sounds like what you're landing us in is this notion that it's the old progressives that are working locally together for the benefit of their communities.
Yeah, I think that we've gotten away from valuing the community sector, and that's why I went into government in the first place. I thought government was where you go
right,
to solve
sure.
the problem. And so
some of us thought journalism was a good place to go too.
So, good point. So you've got government and then you've got business, you know, the private sector, and it's like they're just kind of like back and forth for 60 years, and it's like, well, wait a minute, this community sector here, we got ourselves in quite a pickle, but those folks can get us out of this mess. And so with Aki Energy, we're selling 5 different outcomes. So let's talk about each briefly, just to unpack this idea a bit. And we find this scenario playing itself out. I mean, it's the same chart with different information in the chart. But so the chart looks like this. Is that, well, we're selling utility bill reductions. And we know from Manitoba Hydro and the work that Aki Energy has done. And this is not a tool to try things for the first time.
Right.
This is a tool, community-driven outcomes purchasing, to scale what's already working.
Right.
So if you want to try something for the first time, that's a good use of funding, right? Or grant
sure.
dollars.
Okay, right.
But Manitoba Hydro is like, well, Aki Energy has installed 428 systems, and we've got the bills, the receipts are in, mm-hmm. 20,000 kilowatt hours per year. So, well, who is the financial beneficiary of that? Well, in Manitoba, 85% of people on First Nations are also on social assistance. So you follow the money and you find out that it's the government of Canada that is the financial beneficiary. So, you know, we agree with them to say, well, if we can save you $15 million, will you pay us back 10? Say, well, of course, we don't have any risk.
Right.
We only pay after the fact.
Right.
You're asking us to save money.
Right.
Yeah, hell. And then the associated carbon reductions. Well, Environment Canada is naturally, would have a natural interest in that. The third thing is a reduction in social assistance, because we're hiring people that are would otherwise be on social assistance.
Right.
There's employment and training benefits, which are a different thing, and different government department is interested in that. And then Manitoba Hydro also benefits because they're avoiding distribution upgrade costs and generation costs, and we're helping them reach what they call hard-to-reach customers. So in the beginning with ACCI Energy, it was the foundations that were buying these outcomes just to show how it works.
I see. Okay.
And just to speed things up. So foundations are both investing and purchasing.
Right.
But that's generally how these things work. And it's what nonprofits have always wanted, because we also get ourselves stuck in this no-win situation where we have all the money coming from one department, but there's many levels of government and many departments that are financially benefiting. And those are just giveaways to other areas of government. And so this is a way of saying, well, here's all of the costs, including, you know, not just the ground source heat pumps, but also driver's training and parenting and the training of the workers and the developing the social enterprise, all of those costs, all of the costs and all of the benefits. And it's a fantastical value proposition to governments and outcomes purchasers that it's great. And
so this goes back to what you said at the very beginning, that to change the government from a funder to a customer is the paradigm shift. And what you're exploring now or sharing now is the process by which you demonstrate to that customer that they ought to be a customer. And these are...
Yeah.
So with those negotiations, so in this particular case with ACCI Energy, you had foundations purchasing the outcomes really by way of a pilot to show that it can work, right?
Yes, yes.
Have you had experience with, or is the advice to nonprofits, and many of them wouldn't be at the scale you've just described, to identify those, the places where the money will be saved, and to quantify that to some degree prior to the beginning of the work? Or at what stage is that? Is that an important conversation to have?
Yeah. So this is part of what the social enterprise that I work at now, we just founded 2 years ago. It's called Encompass Co-op. And so there's a dozen of us from across Canada that have experience running social enterprises and interacting with government.
Great.
So one of the things that we do is help nonprofits value our outcomes. We train investors to not just get the financial rate of return, but also the social rate of return, which of course is involved with the relationship with government. And then we also help governments save money. So training civil servants and what this tools of social innovation look like. And there are other intermediaries out there as well. But as we're learning, as we go through these deals, the simplicity is really important. And I think people, like the early generation of this, was a social return on investment.
Right.
Where nonprofits would say, well, we'll just show government they're getting value for the funding. Right. And we've made amazing cases for value, and nonprofits or governments are saying, well, we don't have the funding, bud. So I don't know why you're going through the trouble of the social return on investment.
Right. But the intention was there's probably some unconscious sense that it's important to quantify these things.
Yeah. And I think governments also have the suspicion that, you know, the problem here is that nonprofits are not very efficient. And that's a question from the old paradigm. Mm. Like, let's talk about how effective they are.
Right.
And I love a police chief from Edmonton, Dale McPhee, and I quote him in The Beautiful Bailout to say, we got to move governments from thinking about being efficient to them wanting to be effective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he quotes this number that 65% of social service spending is now on 1% of the population. So we've got governments, you know, we've got one in Manitoba, Dougie Ford in your Ontario, like you're running around, well, yeah, we're going to drive this 65% down to 64, right? Not realizing they're actually making it worse by cutting funding to nonprofits. The city of Winnipeg just cut their funding to nonprofits by 10%. And they increased by the same amount the resources to the police who need the resources because they're expected to interact with the same people over and over and over again, but by the same amount. So it's like, well, we're going to take money from the solution providers and we're going to give it downstream to the police because they desperately need it. It is a crazy, crazy proposition. And then what we have is a nonprofit sector coming out saying, you know, you're so mean for cutting. And I think true and stupid, yes. You know, I'm an advocate for increasing social assistance as a way of getting to a universal basic income, a $15 an hour minimum wage, because it saves government money.
Sure.
If people can afford to pay. So we got to learn how to talk to people. And that's why the Chamber of Commerce is like, well, I mean, yeah, they all, a whole bunch of our taxes are based on these huge social problems. So why wouldn't we ask government, tell government that they should be using entrepreneurial approaches to resolving these exorbitant costs?
Sure. And the conversation that we're having on the large system level just continues to repeat itself. But it's grinding down to very much incremental results. So the narrative has to change. So I'd like to return to this idea of you see tremendous potential in social enterprise, nonprofits. I don't think you've said it, but I would posit that also local small businesses have a relationship to all of this. Sure. That this tremendous opportunity resides in making the shift from government being a funder to a customer, and that we have social enterprises. And what I'm hearing from you, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm also sensing that in the stories you're telling, we're talking about local solutions very much so. These aren't from away solutions to local problems. These are entrepreneurial responses that are designed in place by the people there to address the problems and opportunities that they have to address.
I would, yes, but not because they're local.
Okay.
But because they work. And that happens to be local.
Okay, all right.
So, and there's a key difference.
Yeah, that's a nice distinction.
So, how shall I say this? So the city of Winnipeg wanted to change their procurement practices. Great. So they went and got all their tall foreheads together and they came out with a local purchasing procurement strategy.
Okay.
First of all, the business community was opposed to it. As an example, we make buses in Winnipeg and a New Flyer, and we're trying to sell them into the U.S. market.
Sure.
We don't want them to say, well, we're going to buy local. We're not going to buy your buses because they're from Canada.
Right. Like right.
Gets away from the benefit of trade.
Right.
And so, and our sector was like, well, you're missing the point here. The value isn't that it's local. The value is in the social.
Okay.
And so we just want government to buy value. And then if we say it that way, it's an invitation for everyone to do business differently. And as opposed to an exclusion, like it has to be local.
Yeah.
And here's the other difference is that you look at farmers markets, and I've got more. I've got friends that are in the local food sector,
right,
and they're amazing. But at the farmers market, I mean, you can manage the sandwich board out there that says, you know, come here and pay more. Because everybody knows it's more expensive.
Of course, yeah.
And I buy a lot of food from that sector. I'm doing my own kind of procurement that way, ethical procurement. But they're giving away their outcomes, right? I mean, 75% of healthcare spending is now on diseases where diet is a main risk factor. Mm. So if they want to scale, they don't focus on the local. That's got nothing to do with it.
Right.
They focus on the value that local brings to the table.
Very nice.
And that is like, okay, we're going to do business differently. We're going to stop giving away our outcomes. So what that means is, you know, take example of a venture in Israel. And I love this example because it's nice and clean. They work with 1,000 pre-diabetics at a time, and they get paid based on the number of them that don't become diabetic. So I was like, well, if you were to do that, if the farmer's market were to say, well, we're going to go to government, and we're going to say, we'll work with 1,000 pre-diabetics, and you can pay us based on the number of them that don't become diabetic. Well, it can be about the healthy food, but it can also be about the emotional well-being of working on the farm or living on the farm or whatever. Like those are some of the values that they bring. But so they've been stuck at 3% of the food market forever, and they're not going to go above that. And I think consumers have made it perfectly clear, like, given the price is really important to them, and governments have made it clear is to say, we're not going to pay you for, in funding to avoid these other downstream costs, such as healthcare expenditures. Or in Winnipeg, we've got flooding because the farmers are getting rid of their water fast. We've got phosphorus in Lake Winnipeg, which is killing the fisheries. We got rural depopulation. It's all caused externalities of the industrial corporate food sector. But I mean, governments, they're not coming local food sector. They're not.
So this is very...
It's because you're not valuing your outcomes. So you got to change how you do business and be more...
You've said that phrase a few times, and I read it a number of times in your book. And as a person who's been in business for 30 years, I still struggle to hear what you're saying. The local food producer, they see their product and their outcome as the food.
Yes.
Whereas, and I'm learning this a little bit from David LePage as well, is the product that we're creating is not necessarily the thing that's of value to a market or a value to a customer.
Yes. He talks about it as social markets. I like that. Like, there's another market that goes alongside, and it has incredible value. And
so, how do we find how do we find the customer for the outcomes of the work we're doing, rather than for the work itself?
Yeah. So, how we've seen Raven Indigenous Capital Partners working, and they're unbelievable. They're just so amazing. Because they're community focused, right? They understand it's these indigenous solutions that are going to solve our colonial problems. And they kind of work from the customer on backwards. And nonprofits will be tempted to say, oh, okay, well, we'll just, you know, we've got this social return on investment. We'll just go to government and tell them to, you know, we need more money. Like, no, that's not what this is about. So the idea using the example of the 1,000 pre-diabetics in Israel is because government can track that. And there's three things we're realizing that are important. So these outcomes, they have to be quantifiable, verifiable, and trackable.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, well, you work with a specific population. So, I mean, Build right now in Winnipeg, which is hires people largely with criminal records and trains and employs them in the trade sector, based largely on social procurement with Manitoba Housing. What that means is as they move away or move to more mature relationships with government, is that they're going to say, okay, we're going to take this group of people. So we're going to take 500 people that are, as they exit out of jail, that are people who are interested in working in the trades that currently don't have access to the labor market. And, but we know as a group of those 500 people that 75% of them are going to be back in contact with the justice system within 2 years. That's a fact. Right. So you work with them, and I want to come back to that. And then you track them. So 500 people, how many times have you, you know, in the subsequent 2 years after the holistic solution or the intervention, how many times will they have been in contact with the justice services? Oh, well, it's not 75%, it's 25%.
Right.
Okay, well, you saved a lot of money. Pay our investors back, and we'll do it. We'll do it again. We'll go to the next 500. And, you know, what you're going to need to do is to close some jails. But we're also seeing there's other solutions. So back to this ACCI Energy, there's five different outcomes there. I mean, there are many more outcomes, but they weren't quantifiable, verifiable, and trackable. Like the kids are seeing their parents go the door to work in the morning. We can't.
Sure.
I mean, it's super valuable. Dropout rates at school are going down, but how do we make that connection? So I think that it's, you know, we would look at not just the justice benefits as like, oh, well, of those 500 people, were, you know, 400 of them were parents, and a whole bunch of those parents now have their kids out of the system. Well, we're going to track that, and we're going to sell you that out. It's like, oh, well, you know, a lot of the, some of them were involved with the court system, or, you know, as a reduction in the amount of times the police would be interacting with them. So you just, you kind of got to start with the customer and work your way backwards, because you got to get them to pay, and you can't, like, you know, trust us, our solution will work. Like, it has
right.
In fairness to the customer,
sure.
It has to be. And then the part I want to talk a bit more about is that the solutions become more holistic, and we're kind of used to, like, you know, we're going to do this one intervention. And it's like, no, you're bringing everything to bear on getting better outcomes, and it's going to cost money, but it's an investment, not a cost, right? Mm-hmm. So you do, you know, we're going to do driver's training, we're going to do parenting, we're going to do housing, we're going to do trades-based tutoring, money management, counseling, anger management, we're going to bring elders in, and it's going to be holistic. We're here as long as it takes. Like, and this is what nonprofits have always wanted, is it to be able to have the resources to provide these holistic solutions. Mm-hmm. And that is what moves the needle on this cohort of, say, 500 people that you're connecting with as you're coming out of jail. And the only thing governments need to worry about is the outcomes. And the investors are the ones we have to convince that our solutions are going to work, which is why you don't try something new with this. It's like, well, you know, there's plenty of evidence. Build's been in operation since 2006 that recidivism rates are going to go down. And they'll go down even further if we have more resources to apply, such as housing, you know, as an example. So
there's been a lot of homework done, because you've been in this game for quite some time. I've been watching it for a good 20 years or so, and watching how there have been a lot of false starts, like social impact investing. A lot of social enterprises really did work under the funding model. So things seem to be maturing to the point where things are becoming possible now that weren't possible before, and in part thanks to the work that many people have done to get here. I think this paradigm shift that you're asking for and giving us language for is one of the things that makes, that is different, that makes for new possibilities that weren't there before.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about what you see as possible. If these things were to come into place and to develop themselves into a robust and resilient ecology of how we work together as government, as foundations, as investors, as social enterprises, as civil society organizations, if this were to come into play, what could that make possible? What would be different for the way we live?
Well, First of all, I wouldn't describe any of those things as false starts. This is how we learn.
Sure. Great.
And I talk about it closer to the end of the Beautiful Bailout, this ecosystem evolvement. You know, when I was growing up, I was very impacted by the Mennonite Central community that was, 10,000 villages, and they're selling products that were ethically sourced, and by Nietzsche Foods in Winnipeg that is, now out of business, but operated successfully for 30 years. And
it's a long time.
Yeah. And, but, by the ethical purchasing movement, by nonprofits, like all of these things needed to happen, I think, to get to where we're now at. And so, I think that those are all really important, ways of looking at the evolution of the system.
I agree. So not false starts, but early steps, pioneering steps.
Yeah, and I know what you meant by that. I just wanted to honor the work of people that have come before, because they weren't wrong. They were just operating in a different system and pushing the envelope in the direction they needed to go.
Beautifully put. Thank you.
But but now here we are, and I see disruptive growth rates are about, there's a chart in the book showing like how growth rate, I think for solutions are just going to go straight up, and use the example of disruptive technology, like with an iPhone, a whole bunch of things happened at the same time. They converged. So you've got the flat screen, iCloud, data storage, digital photography, all of these things just converged at the same time.
Right.
And, if anyone had said to any of us, unless you're in the field of studying disruptive technology, that, within 2 years, Kodak would be not selling pictures anymore.
Yep.
And that most of us would have this. It was like, well, that's not how it works. I mean, growth rates just top. So what's happening then is with social innovation is that we have a similar convergence of things happening at the same time. You got your disruptive business model in social enterprises. You've got the emergence of these foundations in the pool of capital that is a great fit for the work that we do.
It's no small amount of money either.
No, $73 billion that we should be able to make a good case to them, right? and then also, we've got governments are exhausted and can't keep up. We've got young people that want careers that match their values. We've got national discussions around reconciliation. We got a better understanding of the quantification of solutions, that there's fields emerging in that sector as well. So, and other things, but they're all converging here at the same time. And I think the match that's going to light the fire is nonprofits just stepping up from the kids' table, valuing our outcomes, questioning funding, and selling those outcomes to government. And I love the quote that apparently Henry Ford said, if I had to ask my customers what they wanted, they would have said, give me a faster horse. And I think if we ask nonprofits now, what do you want? It's like, we want more funding.
No, you don't
want more funding. This is because it's not connected to outcomes. You need more revenue.
Right.
Funding can be part of that.
Sure.
But you need more revenue is what you need.
And seemingly small linguistic change, but it's a very powerful linguistic change to consider that it's revenue, not funding necessarily, that we need more of.
Yeah. And that this idea of turning government from a funder into a customer is the way forward to achieving that for sure.
And so what do you imagine for communities if we can pull this off?
Well, I mean, this is a revolutionary paradigm shift, and I'm not predicting that it's going to happen. It is happening. So, I mean, problems have met their match when when solution providers have resources, right? And we now have a tool to, that can get the resources in a way that government can say yes. You know, and we see governments going in our direction. Not perfect and not fast enough necessarily, but the federal government has a $805 million social finance strategy. The Investment Readiness Fund is a part of that, but a big whack of financing to come along with it. And I think that I'm hoping that it's not corporate solutions that are the money goes towards, that governments are smart enough to get the money into the solutions of the nonprofits. We're the ones that are going to solve the social problems. Mm. But that's pending. We expect to be hearing, some movement on the Investment Readiness Fund soon. And, but the point of it is that the government is starting to move in our direction on this stuff. And that's key. We've got the government of Canada is also doing social procurement pilots. I mean, the government of Manitoba had the word social procurement in a throne speech. And here's some municipalities that are doing social procurement. And I'm LePage, I know, mentioned this in his interview with you, which I thought was great. But, you know, at something like 10 municipalities on Vancouver Island, Victoria, Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, Saskatoon's working on one, Toronto. Winnipeg does not have a social procurement strategy. The Winnipeg Foundation has $1 billion not interested in social innovation at present time. Like, no wonder we've got such major social problems in the city is because we're not buying into what social innovation offers.
We're not actually making use of what's available to us either.
Yeah, and I think some of that is up to us as nonprofits to change that game. And I mean, that involves stepping into our power, which is immense.
And so you've been involved in a number of enterprises where that's been the case, where people have stepped into their power, these kinds of relationships and yes. collaborations have been made. What can you say about what happens to the people who are engaged in these things? What is their experience?
Well, I mean, we begin to engage with government in a very human way. It's like we can all be in this space and say yes, and we need each other to be successful. And that feels pretty nice. But, I mean, we also have this major opportunity for job creation. People are worried about the impacts of AI on jobs in the future. Is like, yeah, is the technological disruption from the convergence of these things, you know, we're not going to need truck drivers. We're just not. But, oh my God, the job creation available in the, you know, family reunification, diabetes avoidance, looking at supportive housing to, and you just kind of reduction in incarceration, all of these things have major job creation abilities. You could just go through the list, and lots of really rewarding employment that's there. And but we have to be more entrepreneurial, and that can be difficult for some to hear. I kind of think, like with funding, you got, you know, people are in the ring, right? And it's an antagonistic relationship, and you got your nonprofit and government, and nonprofits just like they're swinging hard. It's like, you've got to be bigger government. You got to tax more. You got to spend more. And it's like, you know, we're kind of come and tap them on the shoulder. It's like, hey, you're in the wrong ring. Right. This is not the fight that that we're gonna win. You can win that fight over there, which is much better. So, but I heard this saying the other day. It's kind of like an elephant rider. Like if you want to change the direction of the elephant rider, you got to talk to the elephant. And you know, so if you're talking to the business community, it's like, you know what, you were right all along. Government is too big. It's very ineffective. And so what we mean by that is that there's too many people in jail. There's too many people on social assistance. There's too many people interacting with government at expensive levels, such as kids in care and emergency service provision. And so we're going to fix those problems, and it's going to save taxpayers money. It's like, hey, this is great. Let's get the show on the road, right? And you're saying to nonprofits, you've been right all along. Like, all you've needed is more resources, and that you're going to save government money. And so way to go on being right. And, you know, I think it's just a way of bringing everybody around the circle. And working in Winnipeg, you pay any attention at all, you see this amazing Indigenous wisdom. And it's all about the circle. So in the beautiful bailout, the community-driven outcomes purchasing is an infographic, and it's a circle. And we all have a role to play in it. And it kind of gets us back to where Indigenous economies were, and that the things that matter, matter in the economy. And that there's resources for people to do the right thing. And I think that, you know, kind of unfettered capitalism has gotten us away from that. And I guess another, maybe one of the last points I'd like to make is that in some places, and I especially see this in in places like Calgary, where it's just anti-government. And so, you know, we're going to go and do this social enterprise thing, and we're not going to involve government. Here's what's interesting about that is that, well, that's not very entrepreneurial. Oh, right. Why? What are you talking about? We're not going to involve government. Well, you're giving away your outcomes. What business gives away their outcomes like that? Oh, so you're saying in order for us to be entrepreneurial, we need to be engaging government. Yes. And that is how you're going to get to scale. And so that's another example of like talking to people where they're at to move the direction of the elephant. It's like, you're right, Calgary, that entrepreneurialism is absolutely key. So why are you giving away your outcomes? It's like, oh, so yeah, we can do that because we're Calgary. Absolutely. And so we see things like in Calgary, this beautiful mobile food market. And they'd incorporated as a for-profit. And so we did some work with them in Compass, and it's like, you know, we think you'd be more entrepreneurial if you were a nonprofit. You differentiate yourself from your competition, which is private grocery stores, and government will be easier to interact with you. The minute they converted to nonprofit, they were able to value their outcomes. And this is the world we're in, where being a nonprofit is actually more entrepreneurial than being a for-profit, because we're able to capture our unique selling proposition, turning government from a funder into a customer.
Fantastic. I think that's a beautiful place to end this part of our conversation.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Peter, for your work. And I've been a fan of Axiom News, and I've checked in on you, and I'm glad to meet you, and what a great conversation. It's nice to have your experience and of being involved in the sector as a social entrepreneur and as a journalist, to have a meaningful conversation. So I'm grateful for that.
Thank you. You can learn more about Sean's book, A Beautiful Bailout, at abeautifulbailout.com. Find out more about the services available to support your nonprofit and social enterprise journey, visit encompass.coop. You have been listening to an Electric City Magazine podcast. You You can find us online at electriccitymagazine.ca, on Facebook at Electric City Live, and on Twitter at electriccity.on. I'm your host, Peter Pula. Thank you for listening.